Hey everybody, let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. I'm often asked, how do we come up with a new speaker every week? In this case, it was a gift from God. Yvonne came a few weeks back. She asked, how do we get our speakers? And I whipped out my phone and plugged her right in, and she showed up. Amazing. I can tell you that she has she's been in the U.S. 22 years, and she's going to tell you about that and where she came from and how she got sober and came to ask, how can I help? Showed up tonight, and that's the first step for me. I'm sure she's taken all 12 steps, and she'll share that with you.
Hi, I'm Yvonne. I'm an alcoholic. And my Sisters in Solution is my home group. My sobriety date is May 19th, 2016. Thank you all for coming. I'm sorry, I'm a little nervous. So my mind's going a little blank, so hopefully we'll come back to where it's supposed to be. Someone told me a long time ago, they shared these words with me in sobriety, and that was the best word they ever heard, to walk through the fear. So that's what I'm going to try and do tonight. And do this. I just want to, you know, I had written everything down, like notes and everything, but it's in my head, it's in my heart of how I really want to say this. So I'm just going to do it this way. December 1st, 2013, I went to a speaker meeting in Beaufort, and it was the first meeting I ever went to. Walked in there with so much shame, feeling very much alone, and that was just stuck in my head. I was like, what am I doing? And I remember hearing this lady talk, and I just remember how well-dressed she was, and, you know, you would have no idea that she went through what she went through. And it stuck in my head that, you know, after hearing her speak, there was no shame there. So I promised myself, no matter what, I would one day do this. What she did for me, I hope to do it for someone else. So I'm going to start at the beginning, which is a good place to start, I'm sure. I'm originally from a place called Dundalk, County Louth, Ireland. It is actually, as Irish people in that town, we were really proud of the fact that it's the biggest town in Ireland. It's not a city, but it's a town. And they used to call it the wee county, because apparently it was a small county. I'm not really sure how all that worked. But it was known as the border town, because it was located 12 miles south from Belfast and 50 miles north of Dublin. We were just right on what they called the invisible line. And Dundalk, even though we were proud Dundalk people, and, you know, we had beautiful green. We believe they call it the Shamrock Green, but awesome green. Plenty of water, you know, the beach. Dundalk sat right by Dundalk Bay. Just everybody knew everybody, you know. They knew everybody's names, and there was like two banks and a post office, and a lot of towns in Ireland, for some reason, there was always a lot of pubs, you know. So probably maybe 5 or 6 pubs, always readily available. But behind all of that, deep behind all of that, Dundalk was a safe haven for the Provisional IRA. Basically, they considered themselves at that time, because, and I'm sure I'm age here, in the 70s, it was a paramilitary campaign that was set up to get to get the British out of Northern Ireland, because Northern Ireland was belonged to the UK. So you had the Catholics who wanted a united Ireland, and then you had the Protestants who wanted to keep Northern Ireland part of the UK. So I'll explained all that, got that out of the way. My dad was a bank manager, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom, and I have an older brother, a middle sister, and a twin. 10 minutes apart, my twin and I, extremely important in those days, those 10 minutes. My mom considered me the baby of the family. Those 10 minutes, you know, those 10 minutes followed me for the rest of my life, I swear. And it was a good thing and a bad thing, because I was always treated as the baby of the family. So my dad was a really, you know, I want to be careful here, because, you know, I do love my dad. I get a little confused about it sometimes, but you know, I love him. But he was a really angry, abusive man, both physically and emotionally. I was undiagnosed ADHD kid, so I was a little bit of a problem. In the early 70s, he was working in the bank as a bank manager, like I said. And the IRA went into the bank and held up the bank and put a pillowcase over my dad's head and put a gun to his head. And he never got over that. You know, I mean, I don't know, back in the day there was, I don't know if therapy existed or whatever, but he just held it in. You know, I always remember as a child, I just wonder how could he have so much anger and fear in his eyes at the same time whenever he talked about the IRA. I won't use the words he used to use about them. But my dad worked really, really hard. And him and my mom, they loved the wine. You know, my dad made the wine at home, and you know, they drank a lot of the wine. And when my dad was stressed out, you know, whenever he lost his temper, it was usually my brother or myself. He had a habit of liking to just locking the rooms, and you know, if you act out, put you in the room, lock the door, or whatever, which kind of made me a little claustrophobic about being in a small room. I hate it even to this day. So in 1982, to add more stress to my dad, my sister was in a bicycle accident. Was hit by a 18-wheeler, huge truck. It, you know, just sent her flying on the main Dublin road, and she basically she landed on the ground and realized she couldn't get up. And you know, the neighbors, they came running to the house to my mom and saying, you know, something's happened to your daughter. My twin sister and I were in school, and I remember my brother coming to the school and with his boss. And I was in one class, my twin was in another class, and I remember, you know, it was a convent. The head sister, you know, came to the classroom with my brother and the gentleman that he was with, and opened the door, and you know, she was kind of mean, you know, and here she was like putting her arm around me and saying, you know, come on out here. And I looked down this long corridor, and I could see my twin being taken out of the other classroom. You know, I was 11 or 12, and I remember looking at her, and our eyes met, and I knew something was wrong, you know. So they brought us to the office, and they told us that, you know, my sister was, she was 3.5 years older than us, was in an accident, and it was bad. My brother, you know, took us home. My sister was in the hospital, and they explained to us that, you know, we couldn't see her because we were underage, and that a helicopter had to take her to the capital, Dublin, a rescue British military helicopter. Due to the troubles that were going on at the time in Ireland, there had to be a temporary ceasefire that day for the helicopter to take her to Dublin. And I remember sitting in the house at this dinner table. You know, we were sitting down eating dinner like it was supposed to be normal, and, you know, just hearing that helicopter just go over the house and how loud it was. It stayed with me. Stayed with me, you know, for years. And, you know, my sister, she ended up being paralyzed from the waist down. She didn't die, but she never came back the same. She just, I felt, for me personally, I don't know about anyone else in the family, that I lost my sister. You know, she would, to me as a kid, she was my hero. I looked up to her. You know, she taught gymnastics. You know, she worked in a restaurant. She and my brother were both, you know, substitute parents in a way. It was my sister, actually, Carol, was 5 years in a hospital, a year and a half in a plaster, a Paris, a cast that went straight from her neck down to her waist. She was in a rehabilitation for a very long time. By the time she came home, she didn't want me anywhere near her. You know, she wanted my twin was fine. My brother had already left. But me, it was like, stay away. I don't know what it was. What was it that I did? I couldn't understand. And I remember crying and my dad, you know, saying, you got to be a big girl. You got to be grown up. You know, look at your sister. Look what she's going through. I could never get it. I'm 48 years of age now, and I spent, that was my only thing. My existence was to get my relationship back with my sister, you know, make my dad proud of me, because, you know, I didn't finish school and all that stuff, and I was so tied up in that. But I have to admit, though, when my sister came home, a year later we left. My twin and I, and my older sister, we went to Dublin, and I always remember my twin in the car crying because she was going to miss mom and dad. I hate to say it, I'm in the car going, yeah, I'm free, you know. And we went to college, and we got to do what, you know, do what 19, 18-year-olds do. We partied, you know, had fun, drank. But when we came out of college, there wasn't any jobs, and it was more of, because it was a time of bad economy, and the thing was to go to America, and we, you know, my older sister and my twin went to America first. I was there, left in Dublin. I was like, oh my God, I'm on my own, you know, for me and all that stuff. And but I was going to call, I was going to go too, and I waited behind, and a year later, I went to the embassy and you know, did all the paperwork, and everything got turned down the first time. And I remember going home devastated, thinking, oh my God, I'll never be with my sisters, you know. But I went back a second time and was approved to go to America. So I actually did get to America in 1996, and I was so proud of this. Arrived in Hartsfield Airport with $500 in my pocket, bought a bicycle a week later. I used that story in a lot of cover letters for jobs. It worked really well, but it was true, and it worked really, really well, and I literally rode around the corner. I saw this restaurant called La Madeleine, and it was French, you know. I'm like, well, that's kind of close to home, you know. And I went in, I met this guy, his name was Kevin, and he was fascinated with the fact that I was Irish, and he kept saying he was 100% Irish. And when I asked him which part, he said, my great-great-great-great-grandfather on my other side. And I was like, okay. And he decided to give me the name Whiskey. I don't know why. I mean, he just met me, you know. But in his mind, he had decided that all Irish love their alcohol. And I kept trying to convince him that's not true, you know. Maybe he just had figured me out early. But that was basically what happened. That's how I started in the restaurant business and decided I had an opportunity to, I felt, to be somebody, you know, to have a title, to say, hey, you know, call my dad back home and say, hey, Dad, I made it. You know, I'm a manager. And at that time, myself and my twin sister lived with Carol, my older sister, and, you know, we took care of each other. And it was a great start in, you know, in America. But there was times that when I got home at night, my sister, I mean, I remember one time in particular, Carol, you know, sitting in the armchair and having a, and, you know, she nearly finished a bottle of wine. And when someone is paralyzed, instead of their legs going obviously all over the place, the top part of them, just it goes like this. She was very angry. Very, very angry. And, you know, even, I mean, I'm not even going to judge that. If I had, you know, lost the use of my legs and we ended up in a wheelchair, I'd be pretty pissed off, you know. I don't know whereabouts. I think it was right about there. It's like I started getting into this habit of wanting to fix things. I wanted to fix it for her. I wanted to help her. I wanted to, you know, make it right for her, and that wasn't going to work. At this time, my mom and dad had come to visit us in America, and they—I mean, I hate to say it like this—but they still, again, they loved their wine. And I remember one night coming home, and I was the only one working. I came home, my mom was—you know—everybody—they had a lot of some kind of alcohol in the air, and my mom was going through her bag of medication and just like, you know, taking her medication. She was having an argument with my dad, and, you know, I told my mom, I said, Mom, you got to be careful. Don't mix your medicine up and all that. Whatever argument she was having with dad, I don't remember, but I do remember my mom being outside totally, I hate to say it, wasted and crying and saying she didn't want to go on anymore. And again, I wanted to fix it, you know. I was like, Mom, you're going to be fine. You know, I'm thinking she's going back to Ireland, you know. You're going to be fine. You know, why, you know, how can my mother be saying she doesn't want to be here anymore? So that was in 2001. Actually, it was right before the Twin Towers. So it would have been 2000. And I actually didn't see my mom and dad again for like 7 years. So actually, that's a great place to go. 7 years. So I'm just going to go a little further on to 7 years. I mean, during that time, I continued during those 7 years, continued working my way up in the restaurant business, becoming a manager. You know, there was plenty of parties to go to. Had a thing. You know, whenever I drank, you know, if I ever was with a guy, it was like the next day I was like gone. I was like, you know, see you later. I just didn't want to end up in any kind of relationship. I think it was really more because, to be honest, I was afraid of men, and that was because of my dad. So what happened after that was that things just, you know, my sister and I, my older sister and I had a falling out and during that time, and I left, you know, my twin had moved out, and she was going to get married, and I moved out to an apartment, and I was on my own. And I continued to drink. I remember being scared about living on my own, and you know, just having I used to have panic attacks when I was younger, and it scared me. And what helped me if I went home and I drank alcohol, you know, then I'd be asleep and everything would be fine. I focused so much on the job because I just wanted to be successful. And I just, like I said, I kept drinking and drinking and drinking. One day, I was doing my usual thing, was coming home and went to the gas station and, you know those cases of beer, they've got 30 cans of beer in there. And it was like, let me get one of those, you know. And I remember just picking that case of beer up and going, I hope to God one day I just stop doing this. I hope to God that somebody can help me. There was plenty of times I went to work. I never went to work drunk, but I went to work hungover. And I'm pretty sure I went to work smelling of alcohol. I was just naive about it. I thought I didn't smell of it or whatever. But I'm pretty sure now that I did. That help did come along in 2000, and I moved into that apartment in 2002. So that help came along 9 years later. I met a friend of mine at a dog park and had a habit of just, you know, sharing all my troubles with everybody. And, but, you know, my wish had finally come true. Actually, I think someone was listening to me that day. There was a higher power that said, you know, for crying out loud, just send her somebody to help her out. And they did. And, good Lord, this lady was so annoying. It was like every time I opened an email up, it was an article about AA. You know, so I was like, I don't think I have a problem. That I went online and I paid, I don't even know, justanswer.com, you can pay a mechanic or whatever to give you an answer. So I paid a doctor. Legit, you know, and his name was, he went by Dr. Seuss. So he asked me, you know, through the email, it wasn't anybody weird, it was, regular guy. You know, he said, how much do you drink? I said, about maybe, I think I might have given him a low number. Like, I said, 15 cans of beer a day. And he said, well, I can't remember how you ordered. He said, well, you got the basic regular drinker, you've got the moderate drinker, and then you've got the severe one. He said, you're on the moderate severe. You're just doing this sort of seesaw thing, you know. So I said to my friend, I was like, you know, he says this is where I'm at. So if I just cut down the beer, I'll just go back to where I'm supposed to be. She was probably thinking, oh, Lord, you know. And she just was persistent and persistent and persistent with these damn emails, excuse my language. But I mean, so I said, okay, I will go to a meeting. And I picked a speaker meeting, like I said, as I started. And I went there, and I really did feel alone. I honestly felt alone until I heard this woman speak. And it was quite a number of people. And at the end, you know, they had all these colorful chicks, you know, just like in the basket. And, you know, finally someone said, you know, they picked up the white chip and said, anyone 24 hours or, you know, you want to come pick up this chip? And I'm like, okay, me. So I get up and I go pick up this chip and this person hugs me and I'm like, why is all this happening? And I'm just like, everyone's saying, congratulations. There was applause. And I'm like, it's the first bit of attention I've gotten in a long time, you know. So, I continued working long hours and I went to a couple of meetings here and there, but I really didn't take it seriously. But my next goal was apparently to get a sponsor, so my friend kept telling me. I couldn't get a sponsor. And I think part of the issue was that I kept, you know, when it was time to speak in a meeting, I kept saying, I need a sponsor. I just kept saying, I need a sponsor. And I kept going to all these different meetings in my area. Do I like this one? 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 And finally, I came across Sisters in Solution. And I walked into that room. I was hoping no one noticed me, you know, and I kind of hid, went way into the back. But, you know, they really did notice me. It was a women's meeting, and they just were like, they noticed me. There was a lady there, she no longer goes to the meeting, but she would always, always, always be like, if I didn't speak, she'd be like, yeah, you know, say something, you know. So I did, and I figured out that I liked that meeting because if you didn't want to speak, they made you speak. And I felt better, you know, after speaking. So finally, still my friend kept at me about getting a sponsor. And one day, there was not a lot of people in the meeting. There was a lady there, and I went up to her. I was so nervous. I said, can I ask you a quick question? She said, yeah, sure. I said, would you be my sponsor? Absolutely. And I tears just came into my eyes. Oh, my God, someone's going to be my sponsor. This is so amazing. So that lady, the sponsor, she, and I still know her today, she started the steps with me. Step one, meet your powerless over alcohol. No, I wasn't just going to do that. You know, I had to do my research, Google everything, until I finally got this book, Under the Influence, and it talked about binge drinking. I actually thought I was a binge drinker. And in the book, I can't remember exactly how they said it, but it was, how many do you need a drink to be considered an alcoholic, you know? Next meeting I went to, I said, you know, hi, my name's Yvonne, and I'm an alcoholic. I said, you know, that book did it for me. I was like, I said it now, there's no going back. So I went from step one, step two, step three, and none of it was making sense to me. After being 9 months sober, I think it was, I relapsed. And I had this really bad habit when I relapsed, was just getting mad at everybody, and I did it all through email. It was like, look what you did to me, or look what you did to me, and even my dad, my mom, you know, I make fun of it, but it wasn't funny. Because the next day I read what I wrote, and I'm like, oh my God, what did I just do? And I tried to avoid, you know, having a conversation about it. Like, I've said it now. Well, that person's probably never going to talk to me again, you know. And they're still, you know, some of them were still around, some weren't. But my sponsor still stuck around, and I went back, and she goes, you're going to start steps all over again. I'm like, huh? So I did. I started again, step one, step two, step three, and it still didn't sink in. It's nothing. So my meetings probably, I might have just gone one here, one there. Might have just dropped it a little bit. And relapsed again one day before a year. And I actually said this the other day to someone. I went, who does that? Well, apparently people do that. And what slowly happened after a while, it wasn't the being hungover that was the worst feeling in the world. It was the shame. The shame was worse than the hangover. And then suddenly this friend that was sending me all the emails told me I needed to get a therapist. I needed to set up and six appointments or she was never going to be a friend again. And I'm like, you know, be my friend again, that's fine, you know. But then I realized I didn't have any friends. So this was the last person who was going to help me. And I got a therapist who kept saying, uh-huh, all the time. I was like, I think I had three appointments with her, and I'm like, I'm not going back to her again. So I went back to my dear old friend Google, and I looked it up, and I was going through the thing, and I saw a recovery experience. I'm like, okay, I want to try this person. And I might have tried two or three, but this was the only person that called me back. And so I set up to have an appointment with them, and the first thing I said to her, I always remember, is that I'm complicated. And but she never gave up on me. And the fact that I chose a therapist that had recovery experience is what helped me a lot. But I went ahead and relapsed again, and I did that at 9 months. I think, I don't remember anymore, so many times. And still, she didn't give up on me. I decided that I was going to do it one more time after that. And, you know, I didn't plan to do it. I just, there was a lot going on. Couldn't handle. First, I was in a job I didn't like. I hated it. I hated what I was doing. And I was in a bad situation. working at the most stressful restaurant in the world, Shake and Shake, and I had an awful boss. And, you know, I think even with my sponsor at the time, there was times I was in the parking lot, and I'm going to go over to Kroger and get, like, I need to get some beer. I think my friend at the time had tried to tell me about meditation, and I was like, what's that? I didn't get it. I couldn't understand it. So, Then, what happened was I let all the feelings and everything, whatever you do, get to me, and decided I needed one more relapse, and I did, and decided again I was going to lash out at everybody again through email. And the next day it was like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that, you know, and I meant it. I'd always prayed when I woke up. I was like, oh, I didn't email anyone. I hope to God I didn't email anyone. And I'd come in, I'd look at sent emails. Oh, my God. But that last time that I had relapsed, I was just like, I'm not good at this anymore. This is not nice. I don't like it. I don't want to do this anymore. And I knew at that point that these people that were helping me, you know, they weren't going to be there anymore for me. I contacted those necessary people. My sponsor fired me, and she so rightly did. And I was on my next mission, get another sponsor. And it worked out the way it was supposed to. I did get another sponsor. And she had me do the steps again. So I started step one, step two. And step three, and I had been through all these three steps before, and there was something about step three that just caught my attention. I remember sitting outside, and I was on the deck, and I was reading it, and there was this little paragraph that I wrote it down. I'm going to read it to you. Step three is like the opening of a door, which to all appearances is still closed and locked. All we need is a key and the decision to swing the door open. Once unlocked by willingness, the door opens almost by itself. I read that paragraph, and I'm like, damn. Why did I miss that before? And something about that paragraph allowed me to continue with the steps. Still hadn't figured out my higher par. I just knew I had to have one. I thought I was supposed to figure out who somebody. I did the Dalai Lama at one point, and someone said to me, what are you going to do when he dies? So we had a lady at our home group. She heard me talk at a meeting one day, and I was busy feeling sorry for myself, like, oh my God, nobody loves me and all that stuff. And she came up to me at the end of the meeting and gave me a hug and said, you're not alone. And I really appreciated that. And 3 weeks later, she passed. She died. I was like shocked. You know, I didn't know her that well. My home group, you know, they knew her for years. And, you know, I was, like, busy thinking to myself, how can she tell me I'm not alone? And she goes ahead and dies. You know, of course I had to make it about me. We did go to her funeral, the home group, and I was amazed about the support these people had for this lady. I knew I was in the right home group, you know. All these women went to this funeral. I went, and the reverend said at the beginning of the service, he said, you know, can everybody stand up? And he said, anyone who's lost someone close to them, I can't remember, shake someone's hand or whatever. And we did, everyone, whoever did. And then the next thing he said was, you're not alone. And the fact that he might have said you're not alone because he knew those people from AA there might have something to do with it. I don't know. But I took it, was like, oh, crap. Oh, my God, that's what the lady said to me before she died. It was that moment I believed in a higher power. I didn't have to say what it was, who it was. I believed. And that's when I found my awesome sponsor, Rachel, and just went through the steps with her. And I started to notice it was working. Everything they said, keep coming back, it works, you know. A few times I might have dropped the ball and forgot about my tools. And oh, I forgot to mention, my therapist actually showed me how to meditate for real. And now I can't get enough of it. I love it. I do run. I try to remember to keep on track with things. You know, I also am ADHD, and I think I mentioned that earlier. And trying to get the balance, take this medicine, that medicine, you know, everything, meetings, whatever. It's like it's part of life, but it keeps me sober and it keeps me living life for myself. I did get an opportunity to go back and see my dad in Ireland after 20 years, my dad and mom. My dad has Parkinson's and dementia now. My mom is has dementia too. I was very nervous about going back, and I did have an opportunity just to be with my dad, and my mom went out with my sister. When I think of my dad, I think of him locked inside himself, you know, it's confusing for me how angry I can be for him, but at the same time I want to jump inside him and save him, you know. I just remember how he, you know, sat there slumped in the chair. You know, this fine, good-looking businessman once was just, you know, nothing. He's just like, I can't even explain it. And I remember I tried to wipe the drool away from his face, and I saw a tear, literally a tear, come from his eye. I said, Dad, what's wrong? He just said, I'm a bad man. And he said, all men are bad. I didn't quite understand why he said that. I said, at that point, my anger for him had subsided. It just stopped. I said, Dad, you're not a bad man. I never want to hear you say that. I wanted him, you know, I realized that he's locked inside his body, and I don't want him to think that he had failed everybody. You know, I mean, it wasn't just me. It was also my brother. I hate the fact that I put my life on hold to get his approval. I put my life on hold to get my sister relationship back with my sister. You know, when I was a child, I was a victim, but as an adult, I volunteered it. You know, I volunteered to be a victim. Poor me. I now, forgot to mention, I don't work in the wrestling business anymore. I work with kids. I used to do it in my 20s, and somehow I got back into it again. I'm going to tell you right now, I said this to someone the other day, by leaving the wrestling business and working with kids, I believe helped my recovery. Because not in a million years was I going to drink and then go work with a child. I wasn't going to do it. And then you have a 20-month-year-old, you know, look at you and smile and want a hug, and, you know, or he falls and he hurts his knee, or and more importantly, to have the opportunity to go and look after twins. One of them had Down syndrome. 20 years ago, I looked after a child with Down syndrome. And, you know, to pick up this child and have him hug you and have that so much love, you know, for the first time in my life, I knew I was in the right place. I hope... what was really important for me, why I wanted to do this today, is the steps. The steps is what allowed me to meet my higher power. I found my higher power in my steps. The steps is what made me turn that page. I'm still at the beginning. I'm two years sober. I still have a long way to go, but I'm really, really happy to have an opportunity to come and share my story today. I hope I was able to do something for someone like that lady did for me in 2013. Thank you so much.
Time to receive the message of being free. time to breathe. It's not that I don't wanna see. I misunderstood your words to go ahead and forget my world. Oh, and I surrender, believing darkness could be a light. Oh, and I remember that all the dreams are made in the night. And I tell myself not to cry. I feel like a long lost child. It's not by